listening to the Leaders Preparation List of Talks for World Youth Day 2011. This is from session number 4, and the speakers are Father Tony Percy and Bishop Julian Porteous. Bishop Julian will give us a guided tour of Spain, and Father Tony Percy will talk about theology of the body. And if you don't mind me saying, it's one of the best talks on the subject I've ever heard. Then in the second part of the program, Bishop Julian will talk on the subject of discipline. What is it, and how can we benefit from it? Buenas noches, amigos.
To take you there ourselves, Bishop Julian is going to take us on a tour of Madrid, and we're just going to sit here, and we're going to go. Ready?
Yes. So would you like to go to Madrid? Yes. We are about to go to Madrid. We're going to get on a plane, and very quickly go to Madrid. Now, this is Madrid. Now, the first place that I want to talk to you about is the where we're going to meet for the opening mass. See those two? That's right down the center. Oh, whoa, what's this? Here we go. And that is where the mass, see where that building is, that white building? In front of that white building is going to be the altar and the sanctuary, and they're going to have the opening mass there. I don't know how it's going to work, but when Real Madrid won the European Championship, they reckon they had 1 million people there in these streets, and this is where they always meet for big celebrations in Madrid. When something's on, they want to celebrate, this is where they do it. So it's going to happen there in that square around there. So that's the place for the opening mass. Now, the Stations of the Cross are going to leave from that place days later and then go up that street. See, Stations of the Cross are going to walk up there to there. So it's not very long. It's only about a kilometre, and the stations are going to be along that road. Now it's all nicely, it's got trees and stuff along it, and then the end of it's going to take place in another square up there. So I think, are we going to walk along that now? We're just going to go. Here we go. And that's where it's going to end. See, there's a square there, and that's where the end of the Stations of Cross. So we'll all be obviously staying one place, because there'll be a lot of people, but the Stations of Cross will be along that street for the World Youth Day. Now, the opening mass, by the way, is also... that'll also be a place when the Pope comes. So we'll go there twice for the opening mass with the Cardinal Archbishop of Madrid, and then we'll go there to meet the Pope when he arrives on Thursday. Now, one of the other places we want to visit is the Cathedral, and the Cathedral's across over that way a bit. There it comes. There it is there. That's a palace next door, and that's beautiful gardens below it. That's the Cathedral, and we'll show you the side entrance. This is the entrance I went into. And we're just going to go around a bit the other way. That's it. That's the palace there. That's a bit of the palace. Keep going. And that's the cathedral. So the cathedral's in there. So we'll make a visit to the cathedral. And it's really beautiful. There's beautiful parklands all around. It's really a lovely part. And there's the palace. There are lines of tourists want to go in to visit the royal. You can go into the palaces as well if you want to go and have a look at where the King Carlos lives. So that's the cathedral. Now, the final mass and the place of the vigil is just a little to the south of the city. So here we go again. And there it is. Now, the vigil and final mass is going to be held at an airport. It's currently a military and private airport, and so that's I couldn't get inside because it's all military, so I couldn't get inside to see it. But that gives you an idea of the space. It's a pretty big space. And it looks like dried out grass and concrete. So not really exciting, but that'll be the place where the vigil will take place and the final mass. So they're expecting up to 2 million people to come to the final mass. How many do we have in Sydney? 400,000. So five times as many people who came to Sydney are going to come to that final mass in Madrid. So that is going to be quite an awesome experience in itself. So that's the area that will take place. So we'll go in there in the afternoon and then we'll stay overnight, and then the mass will be in the morning, then we head off. They're trying to finish the mass a bit earlier than usual because it does get very hot during the day. So we've got a plan. We've got a plan for World Youth Day. Now, we had to then look at where are we going to stay? Where are we going to stay? Now, as you know, many people, just about everybody who's booked so far, have decided that they'll take the university accommodation. Now, we've actually been able to get right on the ground with this and organise this very well. We've got two university colleges. Now, keep this secret. Don't tell anybody outside of Sydney this. This is a top secret that I'm going to tell you. And all the rooms in these two places are air conditioned. So we got in early and we booked it. Now, the other thing we've done is we've decided, because this gets pretty hot there in summer, we thought the best thing would be to put the accommodation as close to possible to Quatros Ventros, which is the place of the final mass. So see where accommodation one is? That is just a kilometre or two away from the mass. And at the present moment, that's where you will all be staying. It's a beautiful place, really nice. I've even already picked out my room. I know where I've chosen the room. Nice room, mind you. So that's where the accommodation is. Roughly there, I couldn't find the exact address. It's probably just a little bit further down the bottom of that area. Yeah, probably just a little bit there. But that's roughly where it is. See how close it is? Now, the other thing is, virtually across the road, it's actually about the same distance as going to catch a train at Flemington Station, is a metro. And the metro will take you right into town. So you can go to all the things that are happening, you just hop in. And because we're at the end of the line, we'll probably get a seat. So we'll be able to hop in and it'll take us straight into town. There's also a train that goes, and there's only four stops. It's an express train. So you can go metro, or you can go train. The metro will take long because it's all stops. The metro system in Madrid is world class. It's better than Paris, if you've been to Paris. Better than Rome, if you've been to Rome. It really is perfectly clean, fast, efficient. It's very, very good. So in other words, from the accommodation, you literally walk across the road, down into the metro, straight into town, to the various events, and you'll be able to get off the metro as close to these different events. So makes it very accessible. Now, the other place we've got, another place, accommodation two, a place called Getafe, just roughly there. Now, here we go. No, I don't think we'll, what are we going to see? I'm going to go down. It's not exactly it, but I haven't got the actual address for it, but some university accommodation again, and all the breakfast and the evening meal will be provided there, so you get hot meals. The quality of the food is very, very good. Jake will vouch for that. You ate the food. The food is very, very good. So you get good quality food. Now, what we have in those two places, so what's called Getafe and then the other place close to Quatros Ventros. We have secured enough for 1,000. We've got 1,000 beds. So we can take 1,000 people from just from the Archdiocese of Sydney. It's not counting anybody else. Those who go with us for Sydney, there's 1,000 beds. Now, I have to tell you, you might think, well, that's terrific, 1,000 beds. There's nothing to worry about. Now, already 566 of those beds are already gone. So who hasn't registered yet? I wouldn't leave it too long. I would not leave it too long. They're going fast. So we've got 1,000 beds. 566 have already gone. So get in there and book. Make sure you get a bed. Yeah. Yeah. Actually, 500 of them are the school students and 66 are the young adults. You're slack. They've got it quick. So the schools have booked 500. They've got 500. We've discussed it, and at the present moment, Anthony Cleary from the schools is responsible. He wants to use Katafi for the school students. That's what I reckon. I don't know why, but he wants to use Katafi. He likes Katafi for some reason. I don't know why. The other one is better. And I reckon he's got himself mixed up, but he's convinced that I think he's got them back the front. But I'm not going to tell him, because if he wants Katafi, he can have Katafi. Because we've got this really, really top-notch place. I've got to tell you, it's really nice. Very close to Quatros Ventros. So what it means is, you see, we'll be able to get in there, I hope, relatively easily. We'll have a bus. We won't be walking. We'll get a bus, drive you to one of the exits, in you go, and at the end you just come out, bus, and be bused back to accommodation. So we should be able to get in and out relatively easy. Everybody else will be coming, really, most people will be coming from the north. So we'll come in, but our access to the city is very, very good. So does that give you a little taste for things? What do you think? You think we're doing all right?
And that was Bishop Julian Porteous talking about the plans for World Youth Day 2011. Now coming up in the next part of Session 4 of the World Youth Day Leaders Formation course is Father Tony Percy speaking on theology of the body.
Thanks very much. Very interesting, Bishop Julian. I'm going to book in for a room. I can tell you, I've been to 3 World Youth Days. The first one was in Paris in 97, probably before some of you were even born. And although you're not that young, I suppose. And there was 1 million people at that Mass. That's really when World Youth Days began to be accepted. Father Martin. That's when World Youth Days were sort of first really accepted as a worldwide event, I think. And the second one I went to was in Toronto, which was a fairly rough experience for me. So hearing about these rooms is a very interesting thing. Look, I'll get straight onto the topic. We live in a time of tremendous sexual disintegration. I think all of us would realise that. And we live at a time of great sexual sin. That's very true. I think it's fairly obvious sort of statement, but it's very, very true. That, and particularly you young people know it more than I would know. Seeing the different things that do happen. As a consequence of the tremendous challenge that was really leashed into the world, I guess, around about the 1920s, the church took some time to respond to this. John Paul II responded to this, I think, in the most marvellous fashion between the years of 1979 and 1985 with what is now called, as you can see up there, called the theology of the body. So in other words, the light of faith shines not only on God himself, but the light of faith shines on us as human beings, and it shines particularly on our bodies, since we are bodily beings. And he gave these particular addresses between 1979 and 1985. I meant to bring the book down, I forgot it. It's a very thick book with his addresses. If you've ever tried to read it, which some of you may have tried to read it, it's probably a little bit inaccessible because of the Pope's style. Has a certain style, but his basic style is to use the Bible, to use passages of the Bible, and to use a particular type of philosophy called phenomenology. And I was exposed to it when I was doing some doctoral work in the United States. And I sat together with a very fine priest, Father John Ricardo, from the Archdiocese of Detroit. And we sort of began to realize there was something really quite special here, as many, many other people worldwide have done. So let me give you a very basic introduction to it. And the topic tonight is to be as pure as Christ. So I'll get to that in a minute. But what I want to show you first is what the Pope essentially does, so that if you walked out of here tonight, you'd be able to say to your friends, look, we had this very brief talk on the theology of the body, and this is what it is. Because sometimes people have been to talks on the theology of the body, and if you ask them to explain what on earth it is, they won't be able to do it because it's not as clearly explained as it could be. So I think this is the way forward. If I say to you, as a well-catechized Catholic, complete this phrase, original, what would a normal Catholic or Christian say? Original sin. So this we've had in the church for around about 16 centuries. I mean, we had it before St. Augustine, but he articulated it most clearly. We had before John Paul II came along, one original sin. We had it for 16 centuries, which basically tells us about a human experience of I don't do the things that I'd like to do, and the things that I don't want to do, I find myself doing. Is there anybody in the room that hasn't had that experience? Box, are you exceptional? No, I'm not, and certainly Bishop Julian isn't, because he's a human being as well, and so is Father Martin, and so is Father Christopher, and so is Sean. We all have this experience in some way of sort of not quite being together. We sort of feel like we're wounded. Protestants sort of would believe that original sin, you're corrupted. But as Catholics, we don't believe that. We believe that we're sort of wounded. So we can walk along, but we're sort of wounded. So This is a tremendous teaching. It's a very helpful teaching. Now, what John Paul II does is to say, look, there are three other originals prior to original sin. So you have original solitude, you have original unity, then you have original nakedness, and then he treats original sin. Now, I was asked to give a talk in the United States, a bit of a similar gathering like this, and there was myself and a girl we were asked to give this talk. She went first, I went second. And as she gave her talk, the lights went on. When I realised this is what the Pope had done, that he'd given, sort of bequeathed to the Church, a new catechesis about what it is to be human. So in other words, if you want to understand yourself as a human being, is it a good idea to start from where things are broken? It's not. You must say, well, how was life originally intended to be? So this is what John Paul II does. He uses a particular passage of Scripture from the Gospel of Matthew, which deals with marriage and celibacy. He uses that as a sort of a bouncing board and goes right back into the book of Genesis. And he says, look, if you go back to the book of Genesis, you will find this original solitude, original unity, original nakedness, and then you'll find original sin. Now, I can't, as I said, the book's that thick. So if I just leave those original experiences there, if the Pope says, if you have an experience of original solitude, if you have an experience of original unity, if you have an experience of original nakedness, then you will come to understand something very specific about your human body. So in other words, the experiences are not just unique to Adam and Eve. So they had the experiences, Adam and Eve. But he says the experiences are primordial, so that I, Tony Percy, Anthony Gerard, John Percy, living in the 21st century, can have this original experience if I so desire, if it's granted to me, if I'm gifted with it. Now, it seems to me that World Youth Days, in some ways, are like an experience of solitude. They're like an experience of unity. They're like an experience of nakedness. And they're not so much an experience of sin, although I'm sure people do sin at World Youth Days. I'm sure that's a reality, because we tend to be rather good at sinning. So if I have an experience of original solitude, if I understand, as the Pope says, that among all the creatures of the earth I'm rather unique, then I come to understand that my body is symbolic. that I'm not just a piece of meat. Now, remember the Islamic cleric who got into trouble for talking about, you know, women dressed up as meat? Well, of course, there's some truth to what he said. Let's be honest, right? But this is the way a lot of people think. They think today purely in sort of physical terms. So they then think that sex is simply just physical or material. But the Pope wants to say, no, the human body is symbolic. Now, just a word on that. It's a Greek word, symbolein, which means, the word bolein means to throw, and put a sim in front of it, S-Y-M, you get thrown together. So he wants to say that the human person is thrown together. They are both visible and invisible. And the visible dimensions, your body, makes present your whole person. Think about the sense of sight. So I'm talking and you look confused, you don't, but just say you did. Then I'd say, why don't you see it? So that I use a physical term to denote something that's actually spiritual, understanding. Or my hearing. Now, hearing I denote to mean, you know, understanding in a symbolic sense. Or I say, what are you doing sniffing around here? Which means, why are you curious about what's happening? So I use a physical term, the sense of smell, to denote something that's actually a profound spiritual reality, which is curiosity. So this is true of all the senses, but particularly of the sense of touch. So that if this translator here and I were husband and wife, and we hadn't seen each other for say 3 years, I get off the plane, and then I walk towards her, and I just say, we just greet each other without actually touching one another, we'd all say, well, surely they're not in love. So that touch is the key symbol, the key sense that actually communicates love. So hence this whole thing of child abuse, which is so prevalent in society, not just in the church, it's prevalent way across society, is the destruction of the symbol of how we're set up as human beings. So if I have an experience of solitude, then I understand my body is symbolic. If I have an experience of unity, that is, if I have an experience of receiving love and of giving love, then I understand that my body is spousal, that the body is meant for love. If I have an experience of nakedness, it's a very interesting experience, but basically I begin to understand that my human body is beautiful and in some sense free. Okay, so you get the way he develops it. He goes through these original experiences. Now, if you have the experience, then you begin to understand yourself. So it's a very experiential theology. It's not like the Pope wanted to say, look, there's a lot of sexual sin going on, therefore, just apply the sixth commandment. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not commit adultery means you shouldn't commit adultery. You shouldn't sleep together before marriage. There shouldn't be masturbation. There shouldn't be oral sex, etc., etc., etc. Shouldn't be pornography, all this sort of stuff. So he hasn't said, look, this is just the way it is. Boom, 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 boom. He hasn't said, no. If you want to understand yourself as a human being, you must have these experiences. Now, perhaps you can think of your own experiences as men and women, young men and women, that where you've had an experience of unity, where you've felt, you know, deeply accepted by someone, and you've been able to return the love. That's essentially what he's talking about with the experience between man and woman in particular, but also between men and women, just in terms of general friendship. And then if one has an experience of nakedness, which is sort of like an experience of freedom, you begin to be able to see things the way God sees things. So you begin to be able to see yourself, and you begin to be able to see others the way God sees you and the way God sees others. So one of the Pope's phrases before he wrote the Theology of the Body was in a book called Love and Responsibility, where he talks about the human person as being beautiful. Now, he means that not only in a physical sense, but he means it in a profoundly spiritual sense, that the human body, the human person is beautiful. It's a wonderful idea. So he wants to say the opposite of loving a human being is not hating them. The opposite is using them like an object. So this becomes a strong. So once you have these experiences, you begin to understand why you can't treat people as objects. Why sex is not just a physical thing. Why you can't just have sex with someone and sort of throw them away and get on to the next person. So you see the pattern? So solitude leads to an understanding that your body is symbolic. Unity, that your body is spousal. It's meant for love. That's how we communicate love. And then nakedness, we understand how the body is beautiful. So then having done that, then he says, okay, let's get on to sex. So he wants to say, well, if your human body is symbolic, then sex is symbolic. It's not just a physical act. There's something more profound going on. The physical side's important. And that should be a profound experience, he says, for the couple. But it's not just physical. There's a spiritual reality that takes place, a spiritual communication. Well, in the book of Genesis, in chapter 4, verses 1, I think it is, it says that Adam knew his wife Eve, and she bore a son called Cain. So sex in the Bible is described as a form of knowing, not intellectual knowing. It's a different word that's used. It's a form of interpersonal knowing. So the Pope's completely consistent with what you find in the Scriptures. And then, if you understand that the body is symbolic, then sex is symbolic. If you understand that your body is spousal, then you understand that sex is spousal, that sex is actually an act of receiving someone into your life, accepting them, and also of giving yourself. So in other words, sex has a language, an innate language. It's not just a casual sort of exercise. It's actually got a profound language. And language is a magnificent thing where you're able to communicate and set up bonds of unity. So in other words, language has a truth about it. And so sex has a truth. So if you say, well, look, sex is only a casual enterprise, well, then you're sort of lying with your body. You're lying with your whole being, which is why when people get into short-lived sexual relationships, they're never satisfied. Now, how do I know that? Because I've heard a few confessions, and so has Bishop Julian and Father Martin, that people, when they get into these sort of things, we priests know it perhaps better than anyone, that people are not satisfied with sort of a casual approach to sex. This is very interesting, that there's an innate language that we understand that sex means much more than simply casual flings. And then he wants to say, well, then sex, because the body's beautiful, then sex is a beautiful reality. So he has this marvelous reflection on how sex should be a profound experience of unity between the couple. And when they have sex, when husband and wife have sex, after the experience of sex, they actually come back with a new sense of identity of who they are as men and women. Now, this is very important for the culture because a lot of people feel disintegrated through sex. When you read things in The Australian or you read things in Dolly magazine, and I have a look at it from time to time just to see what the latest surveys are, this is what you find. You find young girls and young men sort of talking about their sexual experiences and they're totally dissatisfied because it hasn't been an experience of unity. It hasn't been an experience of accepting and of giving oneself. It's only been a sort of a pleasure-taking event. So therefore, they feel completely unsatisfied. They've crossed over the language of what sex really is. They've contradicted the truth of what sex is. So then, therefore, he's able to say, well, look, then, okay, then the church's teaching about marriage, we can understand the church's teaching about marriage in a much more significant way. Why might marriage be monogamous, and why might a man and woman have to be faithful? Because that's the way sexuality is. It's an act of total self-giving and total acceptance of the other, so it should be between one man and one woman. It helps us understand in some ways the dynamics too of the arguments being pushed forward now for same-sex unions. So what he would like to say is, look, in a heterosexual relationship, you have one man plus one woman equals one. One plus one equals one. In a homosexual union, it's one plus one equals one plus one. Why? Because the bodies and the persons are not complementary. You can only have a unity if there are complementary figures in place. And of course, that's the way a man's body is. The man is set up differently to the woman, but also psychologically he's set up differently. Now, I thought I knew this because I have four sisters and one brother. And I often joke and say that, you know, the reason I have four sisters is the reason I'm celibate. I could see what was coming. And I thought I knew the difference between men and women until I began to hear confessions. And they're a completely different experience of hearing a man's confession to a woman's confession. So it's simply not true to say that men and women are the same. I mean, they are the same in the fact that they're human, but they often are very, very different. They're different physically. Their appearance is very different, but also psychologically and spiritually they're quite different. So this whole idea of the Pope as the body expresses the person. So 1 + 1 = 1. One man plus one woman is a one flesh union. And that experience that they have helps them continue to form their identity as a woman and as a man. So I throw that in tonight because we're talking about this whole same-sex thing again in society. And it seems to me that we've got to find some sort of language in which to help. I think this is a very good language. That's not to say that we're trying to cast aspersions of people who have same-sex attraction. We're not. They're in the church. They come to confession. They go to communion. So they're to be treated with the utmost dignity. But we can't say to people, look, what's a marriage? What this type of marriage is actually a marriage when it's not a marriage. It's some type of union, but it's not a one-flesh union that's going to lead to life. And then the theology of the body helps us to explain the church's teaching on contraception, which has been very difficult to explain in the last 40 years. Ask any priest or bishop who's tried to have a go at it. It's not easy, but with a bit of considered thought, one can begin to see that why wouldn't you use contraception? Because not only does it take away life, but the Pope would say, well, look, it's actually going to destroy your love between the husband and the wife. Because if the body is the expression of the person, then what you do to the body, your lack of acceptance of what someone's offering you, is a sort of rejection in some way of their very person. So that take a sort of silly example, but an interesting example. If a husband and wife want to talk to one another, and the guy says, well, just hang on, puts earplugs in, you have to say, well, this is ridiculous. He's put a barrier to communication. Well, the same thing applies to the contraception. With either the contraceptive pill or the condom or whatever, or IUDs or whatever it's going to be, or these vasectomies that people have and stuff. It does something to the relationship between the couple precisely because it affects their bodily being. And then it helps us explain in some way, I think, in a good way, why we shouldn't sleep together before marriage. It helps us to explain the church's teaching on masturbation and then pornography, which is so prevalent now. It's a great challenge to young men. A lot of young fellows, a lot of girls too, are being exposed to it at very young ages these days. Well, what would be the answer? Well, you know, there's nobody there. Because you're simply objectifying the body, putting it on a computer. So there I have the pornography on the computer. But if I walk around the back, there's no one there. So what I've done is I've objectified a living human being. And it's not in no way represents reality. So not only is it immoral, but it's unreal. And it won't help you in your relationship with a man relating to a woman and vice versa. So perhaps I'll stop there and just take questions if that's helpful. Martin. Father Martin. Yeah, look, the argument from authorities, a very powerful argument. It's a very good argument, as we learned in theology and with St. Thomas Aquinas. It's a very good argument. But some people won't accept it, and so therefore, a lot of people learn the hard way. Yeah, and the challenge, I guess, is to try and present authority. But particularly in Australia, our culture, Australians we're ingrained with the idea of not trusting authority because of our convict background. It has quite a very strong psychological effect on us. Whereas if you go to America, Americans are enamored with authority. They love authority. They love the presidency, you know. Whereas we're quite different to that. But so it just belongs us to, as a church, to actually get involved in these types of things so that everyone can see that what authority means is it means trying to lead somebody along the path rather than kicking them or pushing them along the path. But what is helpful, I think, is if you're in a position of authority, which all of you are, I mean, not just priests, but every baptized person's in a position of authority, asked to proclaim the gospel, that if you do have a language over a cup of coffee with a girlfriend who's gone haywire or a fellow who's contemplating something, if you've got some simple language of the theology of the body, it's much more attractive than simply, well, you can't do it because you can't do it. You can't, you know, sleep with your girlfriend because the sixth commandment means this. Well, that works for probably younger ones in, say, 7 and 8, because the authority does have a good effect with them then, in some sense. But as people climb up the age, you need better reasons. But it's a good point. But what I'm trying to say tonight is that we have here a language, but we've also got these experiences which people can have to help them understand who they are. Because that's the great question. You remember St. Francis of Assisi used to stay awake at night for many hours. This is probably why he died at the age of 44, apart from his fasting. He used to stay awake at night asking God two questions. And the first question was, God, who are you? And the second question is, and God, who am I? Well, that's the great question. Apart from the question of death, which is the great philosophical, theological question, you know, the riddle of death, the question is, well, who the heck am I as a human being? That's what the Pope's trying to say. Look, if you just take the time to have these experiences, if you provide people with these experiences, then they're likely to understand who they are. So what he's done is he's put a language on experiences that the church has never been able to articulate. Had a language for the experience of sin, but we've never had a language like for the experience of solitude, unity, and nakedness. More question? Perhaps my time's up, is it? Monica has always got a question. How's the time, Julian? Yeah, look, I mean, I don't know what they teach in the schools with regards to sexuality, but if we don't do something, if we don't do anything, then we've got kids jumping out of planes without parachutes and that we're not preparing them. So we've got to say something. I know Father Jerry Gleason's very strong on this, one of the lecturers at the CIS. He's quite concerned that, I think he said in the school, I don't know the school situation, so I can't comment. I haven't looked at the syllabus and stuff because I'm in a different game, but Bishop Julian or Martin, Father Martin might be able to comment, or Father Chris. But my impression is that we don't give a lot of formation in this area, and I think it would be a very good idea from year 10 upwards. I wrote a book called The Theology of the Body Made Simple. It may be helpful for you. I don't want to push my barrow. But it's a very thin book, and it's designed for year 9, 10 students upwards. So it's designed for adults to read of all persuasions. Yeah, look, a lot can be done. And my own impression is, I gave some talks at Sydney University and Macquarie University, New South Wales University, on same-sex attraction, believe it or not. And that was an... Were you there, were you? Yeah, and that was an interesting experience, because I thought if I can talk in front of that type of crowd, I can talk anyone in front of anyone, really. But my impression was that a lot of people who are in that lifestyle really are just in it because they're just in it. It's the sort of thing that you do. That was my impression. Because the things that, the way that the questions are asking, I thought, well, you know, they really have received virtually no formation in the truth. So what I was going to say to you is that I'm a great believer that where you preach the truth, grace goes with it. So that even if we feel that people aren't accepting or aren't open to the things that we're saying, that if it's preached in a spirit of love, which is the way we try to do it, then grace always goes with it, and the person's heard it. So I don't know if that answers your question, does it? Or no. Yeah, okay. Father, you're very active tonight. I thought you were sleeping during my talk, but.
Yeah.
Yes, they do. Yeah. Yeah, I think it is. And if you take, for instance, the church's teaching on contraception, which for you guys at the moment probably doesn't cut in, but it cuts in around 35, 40, or perhaps even early, when you're married and, you know, and you've got a couple of kids and there's a mortgage and people are tired and all this sort of stuff. My impression is that people sort of say, oh, well, you know, the church is teaching that, but they've never actually read the document. Now, that document, Humano Vitae, if you've never read it before you go to World Youth Day. It's the most easy document to read. It's a very simple structured doc. It's a very beautiful document put out by Paul VI in 1968. How can you say, I can't accept the teaching, if you haven't given the Pope just 5 minutes of the day to actually read this and say, well, actually, what is he saying and what's his argument? And when you do give it to people who have never, often they'll say, oh, goodness, this is quite enthralling, quite impressive. So I think we ought to have a lot of courage. I think one of the great legacies, where's Jake? I think he was going to move me on, was he? I know he's gone out. I think one of the great legacies of John Paul, not only is this these World Youth Days, but is the confidence to say, listen, you know, don't be afraid to actually teach the truth in a language that people have, but don't be afraid to say it as it is. People might bark a little bit at the beginning, but they will respect you. I think that's very important. Well, I think you're all exhausted. Oh, there you are, Jake. You've reappeared. All right. Well, thanks very much, everyone. Yeah.
Father Tony Percy there, and coming up next, Bishop Julian Porteous on the subject of discipline.
Thank you. We'll do what we did the last couple of times. I'll give hopefully just a fairly brief few thoughts to throw a few thoughts to you. Then we'll break into groups just for about the last 10 minutes or so, and just a chance for you to respond and reflect together on what I'm saying tonight. I want to talk about the disciplines of discipleship. But firstly, let's recall what we've done so far, just to see where we're going. The first talk, we discussed the whole question of character. I was putting forward the idea that really what in life, what's the most precious thing we have? It's not the car or the nice house. The most precious thing we have is the character, the person we've become. And then I talked about, in the second thing, we talked about as human beings, what, and a little bit again, what Father Tony was talking about tonight, we're created good, and we looked at, and Father Tony spoke about those different things, but we know the reality of being fallen, but we're redeemed, and so we're on the way up, we're not on the way down. And we talked about that, and I think it's basic to understand this is the reality of the human condition that we all live. Then we moved on to talk about the question of virtue, and basically we're sort of saying there that virtue is to make a choice. I choose, because it's not just it's not just wishful thinking. I wish I was, you know, very good at this. It's a choice. It's a decision that we make. We make decisions all the time, but they're under grace. It's not just us. It's the fact that as we make decisions, we draw on the power and grace of God to work to assist us in our growth in virtue. And then I asked the question, what do you think is the foundational virtue? What do you think is the first virtue? And this is just a thought of mine. But I believe that the foundational virtue is humility. And then you might remember we broke into groups last month, and we talked about how we could grow in humility. To see that this is going to open the way, the path to growth. Yeah, that we did a whole. There's a whole talk was given on that, so I might move on because it's just a quick recap of where we've come to. So tonight I want to talk about the disciplines of discipleship. Now, maybe that's a bit of a frightening term. I like the word discipline, but maybe maybe you don't. I don't know. Maybe it has these negative connotations. I don't know. Do you like the word discipline? But because I think it's a useful term. It's probably something which doesn't come necessarily easily in our society. But I'd like you to think about something. How do you think you might be able to win the swimming in the Olympics? Just say you want to, we've missed Beijing, so London's the next place, isn't it? Or Commonwealth Games was just over in Delhi. So next one is London. All right. Somebody here wants to represent Australia in London. Okay. Can you just turn up? Just turn up, catch a plane, turn up, help on the blocks, away you go. Swimming for Australia, win a gold medal. What do you got to do? Training, sacrifice, discipline. Haven't you? You know, these swimmers are amazing people. Jeff Hugel was a great example, wasn't he, in the last Olympics. You know, we saw pictures of him when he really put on the weight and he got really, really fat and lazy and, you know. But then he decided, I'm going to swim again. I'm going to swim at the Commonwealth Games. And then he committed himself to that task and succeeded. I mean, it was an amazing story, wasn't it? An amazing story. But what did he do? He underwent the training. And I swim each week. I just do a kilometre, not very much, but I go up there 20 laps. But swimming up and down is not the most exciting thing in the world in one sense. You know, just up and down, up and down. And these swimmers do, you know, dozens of kilometres of swimming every day, up and down the pool, up and down the pool. But they're doing it consistently, building up their stamina, building up their capacity to do it. And they're making a lot of sacrifices. They're getting up at, you know, 5 a.m. in the morning or earlier. They're going off to the pool before work, or they're sacrificing the opportunity of doing a lot of other things rather than being out enjoying themselves. They're disciplining their lives. They're watching what they eat. They're not just getting stuck into pizzas every night. they know they've got to watch their diets. They've got to, you know, concentrate on building up their ability to be able to swim well. So all the time they're building a lot of disciplines into their life because they've got a goal. See, one of the key things for discipline is to have a goal. Like all of us, we like to set ourselves goals, but that goal was, Jeff Hugel said, I'm not only going to swim in the Olympics in Delhi, I'm going to win. And he set himself that, and he committed himself to that goal. He put in the disciplines, put in the training, put in the commitment, and he got a result. Now, discipline is the bridge between the goals and accomplishment. So in other words, you have a goal. In a few moments, I'm going to say, what's our goal as Christians? We have a goal. And the discipline is the way, that it's the bridge that will enable that to be accomplished. Okay, you with me? Now, what about the Christian life? How do we develop disciplines in our Christian life? Because we have a goal. What's our goal? Get to heaven? Is that a fair goal? And also grow fully in Christian character and fullness of what God would want us to be here on earth. But our ultimate goal is heaven, and our more immediate goal here on earth is to grow into full Christian character, what we were talking about before. This is what we see as the most precious thing we can have, to grow to the full potential of what God would want me to be as a human being. Now, there's two notions of discipline, if you like. You may have heard of Stoicism, Stoic. Stoics were a philosophical concept and people who lived a way of seeing life where it was really, Stoic was somebody who's just disciplines himself for the sake of discipline. Now, there's always a danger of doing that. You can just sort of say, I'm going to be a disciplined person, so I'll discipline myself. Stoicism is just this gritting your teeth and being determined, you know, to achieve things, to do what you want to do. That's different from asceticism, which is a Christian concept. The Christian concept comes from the word ascesis, training, exercise, practices, ways in which it can be described. But this is where we have a goal. In other words, we'll do things not for their own good, not because we like it. Just like the swimmer doesn't necessarily like getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning or whatever and going down to the pool. But he sees a goal, he sees a purpose. So asceticism is having a goal in front of me, and so I'll do certain things because I want to reach that goal, achieve that goal. So Christian asceticism is having the goal, as we said, the goal of eternal life, but also the more immediate goal of growing to full stature as a human being, as God wants us to be. And so I'll accept the disciplines, the training, the exercises that are necessary to achieve that. There's a great passage that St. Paul wrote in his letter to the Corinthians. Do you not know that the runners in the stadium all run in the race, but only one wins the prize? Run so as to win. Every athlete exercises discipline in every way. They do it to win a perishable crown, but we an imperishable one. Thus I do not run aimlessly. I do not fight as if I were shadow boxing. No, I drive my body and train it, for fear that having preached to others, I myself should be disqualified. So St. Paul is using the same idea. He's talking about athletes running a race, and they just get it for a crown. We're doing it for an imperishable crown. And so I will take on the disciplines. That's what Paul said. I'm not wasting my time. I'm not shadow boxing. I'm not just doing it for some useless purpose. I'm going to run a race. I'm going to train myself because I want the goal which awaits me. I want to receive, ultimately, the blessing of God coming upon my life. So this is why I'm prepared to embrace the disciplines associated with being a Christian. I think one of the very important points for us, and I think it's very important in our society, and I often talk about it because I think it's a very difficult concept for a lot of people to accept. When we became a Christian, when we were baptized, you might remember that there is this idea, you might have heard the words, we die to ourselves to rise in Christ. St. Paul talks about it in his letter to the Romans. We die to ourselves to rise. In other words, I'm not the center of my existence anymore. Christ is. I'm not just living for myself. I'm not just thinking everything in terms of myself. What do I get out of it? What's it mean for me? What's going to be the benefit here? I'm not living an ego-centered life anymore. I'm not just focused on number one. I realize that now the center and focus, inspiration to my life is Jesus Christ. So I'm going to renounce self, and that's what Christ said. Unless you renounce yourself, he said, take up your cross, you cannot be my disciple. So as long as you're living for yourself, if you're only interested in number one, you can't be a disciple of Jesus. You can't be a true Christian. We say we will take me out of the center and put Christ in the place. That's what it means to be Christian. We put on Christ. Something that St. Paul talked about a great deal. So in Romans, for instance, he said, instead, clothe yourselves with the Lord Jesus and do not obey your flesh and its desires. I'm going to focus my life around Christ because I know he is the source of my life and salvation. And I'm not just going to let myself be dragged away to my lesser desires and the attractions of the world around me that I know are destructive. My eyes are fixed on Jesus Christ. St. John talks about this a lot, and there's another very beautiful and very strong passage of St. John. Do not love the world or things of the world. In other words, don't just focus on everything I can get out of life. Don't just limit my horizons to what I can see, feel and touch. Don't just see the only thing that counts is what I'm going to get pleasure or enjoyment from. If anyone loves the world, then the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, sensual lust, enticement for the eyes, and a pretentious life, is not from the Father, but is from the world. Yet the world and its enticements are passing away. But whoever does the will of God remains forever. So St. Paul is saying, look, it's reorienting ourselves, reorienting our life to say, that's my focus. I'm not going to be just drawn into the enticements, the attractions of the world. Now, they'll be there and there'll be times, sometimes they'll be very strong. But I'll say, no, this is not where life is really going to be found. This is not where I am going to be set free to grow to my full potential, to all that God has in store for me. So finally, we can talk about the idea of disciplines. And I like it as a term, not because it seems a negative thing, but it's something I say, no, I want to, just like I take myself down to the pool or I take myself walking, or all of you would do a lot of things. You do a lot of things because you know that doing these things are going to be good for you. Not immediately, but they will in the long term be good. That's why we take on disciplines. And so, you know, for instance, in Lent, this is just an example, we have the season of Lent, 40 days, which is devoted to this whole idea of strengthening and building up those elements that make up the disciplines of our life. And there in Lent, you know, traditionally we talk about prayer, fasting and almsgiving. They're the three classic disciplines of Lent. Prayer. Prayer is not just something I do when I feel like it. I'll discipline my life. So every day I will pray. Every morning when I get up, I'll build a time into my day and I will pray. I will discipline my life so that prayer is built into the fabric of my life. Just like, for instance, you might say, every day I'm going to go and do a power walk for 20 minutes or something like that. Well, every day I'm going to have a power time with God. I'm going to devote a time to God. Or every night before I go to bed. Or I'm going to find some other time in my day that I will actually have as a discipline of prayer. The prayer is not just an off and on thing. It's not just something which when it suits. No. I want to grow. I want to grow closer to God. I want to grow in my relationship with God. And therefore, I'm going to pray. I'm going to give God time. I'm going to actually build it into my day. I'm going to actually have an appointment with God every day in prayer. That's a discipline, the Christian life. Fasting. Fasting's, it's a funny kind of thing. We all Catholics, we used to have the fasting. No meat on Fridays. You might, you know, that was the old way. You know, the church said, well, look, we won't have fish because somebody goes down and eats lobster and has a beautiful fish meal. Well, it's not much of a sacrifice, you know. So they said it's not about the fish, but it is about doing something. It still exists on the rule books, if you like, that every Catholic should do an act of penance, some act of self-denial every Friday. It's really good to think, what can I do on Friday? Maybe I can go without something each Friday. So this is a discipline, a small discipline. I'm going to make a small sacrifice here. I'm going to do something every Friday. So it's still on the rule books. Every Friday we should do some act of penance. Almsgiving, the other traditional thing. Every penny I own is not mine. I'm not just going to say this is money for me to spend on myself. That I will set aside some money. Now maybe one thing we could actually do, we can be just generous on occasion when we're asked to put a hand in our pocket for this or for that. That's great. It'd also be good, if you like, to decide to set aside a certain amount. You know, there's a traditional thing about tithing. I'm not saying you have to do that. But the idea is the value of tithing was to say it's not all mine. And I won't just give, reach in my pocket, oh, here's 25 cents, that's all I've got. You know, I'll actually go into the wallet and say I'm going to set aside some money. These are the disciplines. Now, these are just three of the traditional disciplines. Penance. Why mention penance? Here is that there's a sacrament of penance, and I really think one of the disciplines for the Christian life is that I will go regularly to confession. Now, what we recommend is once a month. A discipline we can bring into our life is say, once a month, I'm going to go to confession. I line up a particular priest, I've got a particular day I'm going to go and make act of penance, of reconciliation with God, of seeking out God and bringing before God my sins, my failings, and receiving forgiveness. That's going to be the disciplines. So what we do is actually find ways to bring in some basic disciplines, just like the swimmer builds the disciplines into his life in order to be able to win the gold medal. So we find the ways that these are things I'm going to do to bring disciplines into my life. I just thought I just like this quote from Pope Benedict. I thought it was good. In our day, fasting seems to have lost something of its spiritual meaning and is taken on in a culture characterized by the search for material well-being, a therapeutic value for care of one's body. So everybody's talking about diets and all that kind of thing. Fasting certainly brings benefits to the physical well-being, but for believers, it is, in the first place, a therapy to heal all that prevents them from conformity to the will of God. So these disciplines come ways in which it draws us more closely towards the will of God. It directs our lives to be more focused on the ways of God. Am I making any sense? All right. We're going to break into groups. And just a little question. You might like to think, what disciplines could I bring into my life? One of the basic things we do in life is to work out what disciplines, you know, I've got to stop eating Maccas for breakfast every morning or something. You know, we have to bring in those disciplines. And so in spiritual life as well, to think these are things I need to do if I'm going to grow a spiritual life. So hopefully that was been a good exercise tonight. So I'll pass back over to Jake now, who's just going to make some final comments. And then we'll conclude the night.
Okay, so just to quickly wrap up. So that was the last one for the year. But next year we do it all again. There's another... Wow. So next year we do it all again. There's another great few sessions next year. We've got Cardinal Pell coming, I think, on the first talk back next year. First or the second. So next year we do it all again. But just to let you know, I think I might have the date in here. Pencil in your diaries, February 16th. So that's the next date for this. Back soon. Same time, same place. Awesome food, awesome speakers.